I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Welcome to The Connection. Why are we so tough on ourselves? I know I am. Still bothered by and ashamed of the mistakes I've made in life, the people I've hurt, the times when I did not live up to my own expectations. Psychologist Diane Hill writes in her new book, Wise Effort, that it's hard to be a human. We don't always know our thoughts and feelings. We can get derailed by the unreasonable demands we put on ourselves, the tired old stories we tell ourselves about ourselves, and the inflated expectations of other people. Diana shares her own struggles with perfectionism and people-pleasing and what she has learned about how to find balance in her life by focusing on what matters. She draws inspiration and guidance from Buddhism, from acceptance and commitment therapy known as ACT, her work with patients, and her personal life. She joins us on The Connection today to talk about what gets us stuck and how we can use our strength and our talents, which she calls our genius energy, to create a life of meaning and purpose. She has a private practice in Santa Barbara, California. She's also the host of the Wise Effort podcast. And Diane Hill, nice to have you with us today on The Connection.
It's so great to be here.
You know, I have a broad-based question, but I was reading your book and sort of just thinking about the world that we're living in. What do you think it is about modern life that makes it so hard to, I guess, both be ourselves, but also to live in a very conscious, present way in this rather complicated world?
Well, some would say there's a bit of an evolutionary mismatch, right, between our modern world and how our bodies and brains were designed, everything from the speed at which everything is going to the way in which our threat system can be activated all over the place. There's a bit of a overstimulation of our drive system and our threat system, and maybe an understimulation of our belonging and our connection and our soothing systems. And that combination can be quite challenging, where we feel like we're in overdrive all the time. We're, you know, just looking at my email inbox, I have 1,507 unread emails, right? And I could just look at that little red number in the middle of this interview and start to feel a little bit threatened, or, oh, I need to go get that done. And, but that's everywhere. That's everywhere all the time. So it's difficult to settle or feel contentment.
And I do want to talk about our inner worlds, but I'm also thinking of this world that we're living in, and you use the word threat. And I think many people just feel very upset about the state of our country, seeing cruelty, living sort of bathed in conspiracy theories. It's hard not to feel as if we are under threat and not know exactly what to do about that.
Well, we have access to things that are threatening to us all the time. You know, we could, when I was growing up, we had 13 channels, and those channels would stop at about, you know, 11 o'clock at night. But 11 o'clock at night, you could turn on and the TV and see anything that would be threatening. But there's an important part, I think, that sometimes people don't give enough credit to, which is the things that you are worried about, the things that keep you up at night, the things that make your heart kind of pound a little bit stronger are usually the things that you care about. And it points to your values and what matters to you, which actually gives you a little bit more agency. Because if you can identify, oh, I'm worried about this because I care about that, then I can take a bit of action, a little bit of behavioral action towards doing something to alleviate suffering or doing something to show my care. Now, an example of that might be, say you are concerned about climate change.
Sure.
I work a lot with university students. I'm part of this 10 UC campus-wide research project led by Alyssa Eppel. And part of the reason why I teach this class is because I worry so much about our climate. I go outside and I see the changes in just my neighborhood since I was a little girl. And it worries me. It worries me for my kids. And that worry points to what I care about. And then I can go out and actually do something about it. And we know that action can bind our anxiety. So that's the, most of the time what we do is we feel threatened and then we freeze, or we feel, or we just turn it off, or we look away. And I take a little bit of a different approach, which is to move towards that which bothers you. Not to get submerged in it, but actually to make contact with what's under it, so then you can do something about it.
Well, let's talk about our inside selves, I guess, our feelings and our thoughts. And one of the things I got from your book is to have those feelings and thoughts and not to have judgments about them, which is, I think, really hard to do. Why do we need to be able to feel the bad, the things that we feel badly about, in order to feel the good, the things that we feel good about? Why do we need both?
Well, first, I would say there's no good feelings or bad feelings. All feelings are functional. So humans evolved, every single feeling that you have has an important function. And you could pick any feeling, even something like guilt. Guilt has an important function to it. We feel guilty to prevent us from doing things that harm other people or harm ourselves. So there's a motivation behind every single feeling. And when clients come in to work with me, their most common request is, I want to stop feeling this.
Sure.
I want to stop thinking about that. And I want to stop remembering this. And I will look at them and say, I'm sorry, I'm not that kind of therapist. I can't make you stop feeling. I can't make you stop thinking. And I can't stop make you stop remembering. And in fact, I wouldn't want to. Why? Because those feelings, if you feel guilty, I was working with a client yesterday who was feeling guilty about she's caretaking her mom. You know, if she feels guilty about not spending enough time with her mom in the hospital, it says a lot about what she cares about.
Right.
She loves her mom. But then the problem is that she feels guilty when she's with her mom, but then she feels guilty because she's not with her kids. Right? Oh, that shows that you care a lot about your kids. So the difficult feelings, the uncomfortable feelings, have a lot of information in them. And then we need to get more skillful, not at getting rid of our feelings, but in being with and understanding our feelings. So then we act from our values or from our heart or from the type of person we want to be, even with these feelings.
Well, even using that example about the guilt about the mother, the guilt about the kids, I think we just feel so, I'm speaking for, you know, the human race here, we feel so pulled in so many directions and so much responsibility and maybe even control over all the vagaries and things that can happen in life.
Yeah, I do feel sometimes we feel solo in our lives. And one of the things that I think is important is for us to remember that we are not alone. So you could take that example of your caretaking
Sure.
your mother. There's a lot of other folks that are part of this system that are supporting and caretaking of your mother. And how could you make contact with some of that interconnection? And that actually can be one of the most helpful things for us, is to realize that we are not solo species. Humans were not designed to operate alone.
No.
We would not survive very long. And when you try and do it all yourself, you end up not doing a great job at it. So we're much better when we collaborate. And that's part of, if you think about sort of the how our minds evolved, we have a competitive drive for sure. We've evolved to go get resources and go get things done and build a house and find a mate. But we also have a huge part of our nervous system that is a collaborative, pro-social drive. And that part of, I think, our nervous system in particular is not being utilized as much as we could utilize it.
I'm looking at the title of your book here, Wise Effort. And we've sort of touched a little bit on what that wise effort is about. But for our listeners, how do you define it? And it's very specific.
It is specific. I first want to say the roots of wise effort, those words are not mine. Those come from the Buddhist Eightfold Path. So Buddhism has all these numbers in it. There's like the Four Noble Truths. And then the fourth noble truth is the Eightfold Path, right? And the Eightfold Path is considered to be the path of awakening, and it has all sorts of suggestions. It's quite behavioral, really. I think that Buddhism is quite a behavioral psychology.
That's interesting.
In that it says things like have wise speech and have wise concentration and have wise livelihood. Marty, you and I right now we're practicing wise livelihood. And on that Eightfold Path is wise effort. And that word, wise effort, always kind of piqued my interest because it has to do with our energy. How are you using your energy? Are you using it wisely? Are you pouring too much energy into things that don't really matter to you? And maybe you actually need to put a little more energy into some things that do matter to you. Maybe you're misdirecting your energy. So it comes from Buddhism, but then the way that I've conceptualized it has been integrating a lot of psychological science, especially ACT, as well as my own personal experience of my life of misuse of my own energy. Our mess is our message. This is sure. why we practice what we do. But then also watching, hundreds of clients that have incredible genius to them. They have these incredible strengths. And then it gets kind of misdirected. Maybe they're not using them in the ways that they want to. They come in because there's a discrepancy between how they're acting and how they want to be in the world. And wise effort is the course correction.
Well, and the first principle is getting curious. And that really struck me because I was wondering whether being kind of the journalist of our own lives, because journalists ask questions. I mean, curiosity is in part what drives journalism. Why, when, how, where? Do you find that helpful? I mean, that being curious sort of unlocks and opens up a whole world of options.
Journalists ask questions and journalists are impartial. They don't judge. They don't come in, or they do their best to not come in with a preconceived sort of, this is right, this is wrong, this is good, or this is bad. And, and the same thing with toddlers. The toddler comes across a snail in the road, they'll pick it up and they just look at it with like a head tilt and a little bit of a, huh? Judd Brewer, who's a neuroscientist at Brown, talks about this as interest curiosity, the questions that lead to more questions. It's not deprivation curiosity, like I need to find the answer. It's, I wonder why. And when we can bring that type of non-judgmental curiosity to our own struggle, then we can actually start to untangle it. Like if you think about like when you get a necklace all kind of tied up in a knot in your jewelry drawer, and you, instead of tugging at it, you look at it, you're curious. I wonder if I pull this part gently, maybe that will untangle. And then if that doesn't work, maybe I pull this part, but you're not judging it. And that is the approach that I think is most foundational when we start with wise effort, because usually we need wise effort because there's some place in our life where we're stuck, in our marriage, in our work, in our health behavior. And our automatic tendency is to go either to forcing or judging or avoiding. Instead, have that little curiosity.
We are talking with psychologist Diana Hill. She's got a new book called Wise Effort, How to Focus Your Genius Energy on What Matters Most. And I love the fact that you put journalism and toddlers together in the same boat. We've got much more to talk about after this very short break. Do stay with us. We'll be right back.
WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives. One moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
You're listening to The Connection here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowen, and just a recap here, it's easy to feel overwhelmed by the daily demands of work, of family, of life itself, when doing too much feels like it is not enough. Our guest, psychologist Diana Hill, has a new book. It's called Wise Effort, and it's about finding a better balance in life by identifying what she calls your genius energy. So Diana Hill, what is your genius energy?
I think when we ask that of people, they feel a little bit like, ooh.
Yeah, exactly.
Are you calling me a genius? That's kind of narcissistic.
I know. Yeah.
And I first want to just sort of define genius energy is your talents, your strengths, your je ne sais quoi. It's what makes you you. It's your emotional intelligence. It's when you think about your, five best friends, and why do they call you and not the other friend in your friend group? What are they calling you for? It's the things that come easily to you. It's like my son the other day, we had all our AirPods, and all of the little AirPods were missing their pieces, and he put them out on the table, and he was able to, it frustrated me, but he was able to find the missing parts to match, because he's a problem solver. That's his genius, right? So I just want to say that up front. Sure. Everyone has a genius. We have many of them. And for me, what I've discovered, my geniuses, which also are very problematic for me, are my persistence. I will persist to the point of, like, to the bone, literally. And that's what, you know, gets you through a PhD program.
Sure.
But also can be very problematic if you're persisting in a way that is harmful to you or towards things that actually you don't want to be doing. And then another aspect of my genius energy is emotional sensitivity. So I was like the kid at Thanksgiving, and I'd be at the Thanksgiving table, and I knew which couple was going through a divorce, and I could feel the tension between them. And I knew who was drinking in the kitchen. And I knew, you know, like I knew everything that was going on because I had these emotional feelers. And those emotional feelers, again, can be very beneficial if you're a therapist or you're doing group therapy, but not as beneficial if they're just like all over the place at Thanksgiving dinner. So those are some examples.
Well, and I can totally relate to the sort of observer part. In my family, people didn't argue, but I knew if there were problems, and I mean this literally, was how my parents held their fork. That that was like my antenna would go up and that would tell me, uh-oh, there are problems here. But other than that, you know, it all looked very rosy and good on the outside.
Right. And if you think about that as a interviewer or as a journalist, you are paying attention to how people hold their forks. And that's very useful. In an interview, you have to be really clued in to things like body language and the sound of someone's voice or when they're about to pause. That kind of really focused attention on another human is your genius and will make you an incredible interviewer. And could be really problematic if you're a kid and that's your parents, or exactly. In a relationship. Like you could use that, you know, it's sort of like really could be problematic if you're breaking apart every single move of your partner and not just letting them kind of be free.
Be who they are. Yeah, exactly. I do want to talk a little bit about you. And I appreciate the fact that in this book, you tell some experiences that you had both growing up, I guess, as a teenager and even into your early adulthood. You had bulimia and struggled with body image. And it sounded, the way you wrote about it, that there was the sort of Diana Hill that everyone saw was smart and she was a good athlete, she was attractive, all this stuff. And then there was the inner Diana Hill that was very different. Can you talk about those two people?
Yeah, I think the inner Diana Hill was that emotionally sensitive, picking up on all the energy and not knowing what to do with it. And I actually, before I was bulimic, I was anorexic. Mm. And I learned early on that if I didn't eat, I had this like super skill that I could turn it all off. If you run enough miles and you don't eat a lot of food, you turn off your whole system. And I went on to be a clinical director of a treatment center for eating disorders, and I would see this all over the place. Like, wow, you got really skillful at turning down the volume of those intense feelings that you had. The problem is it, you know, has the potential to kill you. So sure. I was, in treatment early on for anorexia, and then it swung into bulimia. I remember when I was in college, I was the top student of like anything you could be the top student of. And I was the top student in organic chemistry at this large university, UCSB. And I remember going up to get the organic chemistry prize and the professor giving me the prize. And it's like, isn't this what you always wanted? But inside, it felt so empty because I knew what I had to do to get that. Like I actually had to destroy myself in order to get that achievement. So it was this balance of both trying to manage the intensity of my feelings. You could do this with an eating disorder. People do this with alcohol. People do this with workaholism. In ACT, we call it experiential avoidance. You are avoiding what's underneath your skin, your thoughts, your feelings, your sensations, your memories, your urges. And then the flip side of that, I also had what in ACT is called experiential attachment, which is a newer thing that's being researched and a newer term, which is you are going after, you're craving, you're grasping some kind of external thing that you think is going to make you happy. And that external thing for me was achievements. But the problem is that the finish line kept on moving further and further. So yeah, you get the organic chemistry prize and then you get into your PhD program and then you need to be the best. It just is never ending. The finish line keeps on moving out. So you end up chasing after things to make you happy that don't really make you happy. Even if you get them, they're not as good as you thought that they were going to be good.
Yeah.
And then you're shutting off the things that are inside of you because you're avoiding them in whatever possible way you can. And that kind of leads you to feel a little bit empty and definitely disconnected from yourself. It's not wise effort.
It is not wise effort. But you also describe, and I guess this is when you were running and denying yourself food, looking down at your legs and almost like seeing them for the first time. And you saw that they were essentially sticks, and that you had either distortion, you know, that you could not see yourself the way you really were, and perhaps the way other people saw you. You saw something else until you looked down and you saw what your thighs look like.
Yeah, they looked like, you know, when you're walking on the beach and you find like a bird bone.
Yeah.
You know, and many of us have that wake up. Whether it's,
and that
it's
was a wake up, small. And that was a wake up,
yeah,
for you.
It's a wake up. I mean, it can be small, like in the kitchen, all of a sudden you hear the tone of your voice that you did not hear before. You were just talking to your partner with that tone. That's a little bird bone moment, like a wake up. Or maybe you wake up, you kind of like see yourself in the groundhog day of your business or your career. Like, wow, really? This is where I'm at this age? Waking up to that. Or maybe you have some kind of addiction. So for me, that was, waking up to 72 pounds and seeing my legs. And I remember I went over and lived next to this, like, she's like a second mother to me. And I remember going over to her house and saying, I need help. I can't do it.
Really?
And that was a wise effort move.
You were taking care of
like
yourself.
That. Yeah. Or just saying, I can't do it. I can't do it on my own. And pretty soon after that, I was withdrawing from school and going to a treatment center. But here's the thing. I go to the treatment center and I'm asking them to fax me work, you know, because we get back into it so quickly. So we can have many wake ups, but then we forget. And this is just part of the human condition. There's a Buddhist teacher, Adyashanti, who talks about this. Francis Weller, who talks about grief in terms of we're the only species that forgets who we are over and over again.
Whoops. Okay. Oh, you just lost your earpiece. Okay.
Yeah,
that's all right. No problem. And she's putting her earpiece back in. Let me just quickly reintroduce our guest. That's Diana Hill joining us today on The Connection. And again, she is a psychologist in private practice. She's got a podcast. The podcast is called Wise Effort, which also happens to be the title of her new book called Wise Effort, How to Focus Your Genius Energy on What Matters Most. And she just lost her little ear pods, which are now back in. Let me just pick up on something. And then I do want to move on because you said something that I could really connect to, that when you were disconnected from your body, you did not see your body the way it actually was. It disconnected you from your feelings and from the outside world and from that other part of yourself. I mean, the show was called The Connection, but this was such a powerful disconnection that you came to understand and I guess and deal with as well.
Well, it wasn't just not seeing my body. It was not feeling my body. And I went on to actually research interoceptive awareness, which is a term in psychology, which is your ability to sense and feel what's happening inside. You can feel your own breath. You can feel your own heart beating. you can feel your hunger, you can feel your fullness, you can feel anxiety or stress in your trapezius, right? All those things, information, important information. And there's some research to show that folks that have higher levels of interoceptive awareness make better decisions. They even did a study with stock market traders that they made more money if they were better able to detect their own heartbeat.
Wow.
Because in our body is a source of wisdom. It has its own learning history of this is right for me, this is wrong for me. Our body is whispering all the time, this whole body yes or whole body no. And if you override that over and over and over and over again, you are blocking out important wisdom that could help guide you in making decisions like this job is right for me or that relationship is wrong. And part of my work was actually to find my way back to my body. For me, that was through yoga, reclaiming my relationship with movement in a totally different way. I went to a yoga ashram in Boulder. I have so many dropouts. I like to tell my kids that I dropped out of every school that I've ever been in, just to give them a little, you know, freedom.
Right.
But I dropped out of high school. I withdrew from college. I withdrew from graduate school. I was in a PhD program researching eating disorders. I was researching bulimia. And I had to withdraw because I relapsed while I was there too. And when I withdrew, I went to a yoga ashram. And that's where I started to learn a different way of being in my body, which not just looking at my body, being in it.
Well, and it sounds like it's even more than forgiveness, that it is acceptance. And perhaps that's part of the same coin.
Yeah, acceptance is... The way that I define acceptance, sometimes there's a little bit of reaction to the word acceptance, like the reaction to the word genius. I don't want to accept that.
Yeah.
The way I define acceptance, actually the root of it is to receive. The Latin root is to receive. It's to allow. It's to have it be what it is. It's to welcome. Sometimes when I'm training therapists, I'll have them circle up and try and we'll make acceptance soup, like put in as many words as possible besides the word acceptance. Because if you use the word acceptance with your client, you say, just accept your mother-in-law, they will shut
down.
They'll
fight you.
so there's many other words and you could try them on for yourself of like, how does this sound in relationship to my body or this difficult relationship? Does welcome or allow or make space for, I love that one, breathe in. To let it be, like the Beatles. These are all words for acceptance. And then maybe that's a step towards forgiveness. Forgiveness is also receiving, but forgiveness is something that brings also this quality of letting go, willingness, letting in.
But there is a kind of essential paradox there, which is by accepting. Rather than forcing ourselves to try to change something, it sort of paradoxically allows us to maybe look at ourselves or look at this thing that we're trying to deal with in a new and different kind of light.
Yeah, one of the secret tactics of therapists is that when it's the paradox of acceptance and change. So I learned this from Marsha Linehan. I was very lucky to train a little bit with Marsha Linehan, who's the founder of DBT, when I was in graduate school, because that's what I was researching. And what she always taught was when somebody is pushing back, they don't want to change. Hmm. You want to, if you can imagine, it's like a teeter-totter. You want to step on the side of acceptance. You want to step on the side of allowing. And then once you get a little bit of opening, then you step on the side of change. So yes, it is a paradox that the more that we are willing to accept something, the more likely we will be able to change it. But sometimes we go straight to change.
Yes, we do. Yes, we do.
Yeah.
Let me read this section on human yearnings. And your book is a lot about ACT, this acceptance and commitment therapy. But you define the kind of six parts of that. And I think they're important to understand. We yearn for belonging and understanding. We yearn to understand ourselves and our context. We yearn for emotional depth and the freedom to express the full range of human emotions. We yearn to ground ourselves in the here and now, to be present in our lives. We yearn to feel our life matters and has a sense of purpose and values. We yearn for growth, to learn new skills, achieve goals, and build mastery. Those are inspiring. I think it's hard to argue with any of those. And yet we know that we do struggle with yearning and feeling entitled, I guess, to try to take on some of life's struggles.
Those yearnings come from Stephen Hayes, who's the founder of ACT.
Right.
And they're very well hashed out in his book, A Liberated Mind. And they're evolutionarily driven. So yearning to belong is because we evolved to be in groups, right? But the way that we look at it in ACT is that you can have that yearning and you can respond in either misdirected or values-based ways. So if we have a yearning, for the first one, yearning to connect.
Sure.
If you go back to me in college trying to get the organic chemistry prize, that's how I was yearning. Like I thought, oh, if I get this, then I'll be liked. Then I'll be enough. Then I'll be included. And here's the irony of it. The more that I did that, the less people liked me, you know? You don't really want to be friends with that girl, you know, that's like stepping on everyone to get to the top. But I thought that's how I could get approval. And if we go back to just the core yearning, oh, you're yearning to belong, but you're, you know, chasing after the award so that you get some kind of, so you prove yourself, it's not working for you. Actually, how could you feel more belonging? How could you meet that yearning in more wholesome and healthy and authentic and beneficial ways? And that is definitely wise effort, right? So the foundation, especially from its Buddhist roots, is to put our energy towards what is beneficial, not only for yourself, but also for others. Every single one of those yearnings you could use in, you know, misdirected or values-based ways.
We're about a minute away from our second break here, but I wonder just how important it is then to name it, to give a name to this thing that we're dealing with.
To name our yearning?
Yeah, to name
absolutely
our struggles, our demons, or however we call them.
I think there's a two-step process. First, we feel it, then we name it. Sometimes we name things too quickly. It's like the color red. If you were just to look at a strawberry, the way that my grandma used to paint a strawberry, she'd put all these different colors on a palette. She'd put a little cadmium red and a little bit of okra and maybe even a little bit of blue. So before we call a strawberry red, just look at it, feel it, sense it. Before you name something, feel it in your body, be with it. And then you could give it a name, and that helps us maybe communicate it or share it with somebody else. But yeah, it's probably two steps.
Two steps. Let's take that short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation with psychologist Diana Hill. Again, she's got a new book. It's titled Wise Effort, How to Focus Your Genius Energy on What Matters Most. Wise Effort is also the name of her podcast. We have much more to talk about after this very short break. Do stay with us. In fact, we'll be talking about the stories that we tell ourselves. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives. One moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
You're listening to The Connection here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss Cohen. Our guest psychologist Diana Hill writes in her new book, Wise Effort, that it's hard to be a human. And that's what we have been talking about during this hour. Also talking about how she has drawn inspiration and guidance from Buddhism, from a therapy called ACT, which stands for Acceptance and Commitment Therapy. Some of the latest in neuroscience, her work with patients and her own struggles. Well, let's talk about narrative. And your book got me thinking about, you know, the narrative that I certainly carry around in myself about myself. I assume that comes from our childhood, things that we were told about ourselves, things that we believed, our family, our teachers, our friends, our community, that we have this narrative that sometimes serves us and sometimes it feels as if it is our undoing. How do you see narrative?
Well, I love that you were using all these different interacting, you know, pieces that contribute to what's going on in our mind. And I just want to say that the thoughts that you have are not really yours to begin with, right? So one is just even just how our brain is designed to pay attention to certain things and not pay attention to other things. And that oftentimes the things that your mind is paying attention to are the least helpful things. You know, someone with social anxiety, they're paying attention to every single word that they're saying and they're slipping on their words. And then all of a sudden they start slipping more on their words, right? They're not paying attention to maybe their feet on their floor or the slow breath in their belly or the tree outside their window. So that's one thing about our mind is that it's kind of inflexible in its attention. And what ACT trains us to do is to have more flexible attention, to choose where we put our attention and to be the chooser of that. But another aspect of our mind is that it's constantly producing thoughts. One of my friends and teachers, Jack Kornfield, talks about how your heart beats and your lungs breathe and your mind, it thinks constantly, 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 constantly. And some of those thoughts are rooted in these core stories that we develop about ourselves. I've had clients that will, you know, they'll tell me about something that they, you know, developed a story about themselves when they were 7 and they're still carrying it when they're 47 and they've never challenged it. And it become this self-confirmation, you know, confirmation bias where they say that they're, you know, they're a bad writer or they're bad at math or they can't run or they're, sometimes you hear this in relationships, I'm a bad chooser. I choose the wrong people. And then they, all their behavior is shaped around that. So our stories in our mind can push us around if we don't learn how to be more skillful with our minds and that we aren't our thoughts.
Well, it's interesting you say that because I was never a particularly good student, but I had several teachers that really drilled that into me that I wasn't college material, for instance. And one was an 8th grade teacher, Miss Morton. And I, you know, she still weirdly can lit, not all the time, but every now and then it's in my head, you know, telling me that, you know, I'm not smart enough to be able to do X, Y, or Z. And here I am, you know, baby boomer in my 70s. And Miss Morton is still in my head.
That's so good, Marty, because if you were my client, what I would do with that is help you start to flesh that out a little bit. Like, what's the tone of Miss Morton's voice?
It's very punishing. Yeah.
Yeah. Very punishing. And can you generate Miss Morton in your head if you wanted to, right? And can, what happens if you try and not think about Miss Morton? Does Miss Morton just get louder, right? As soon as you start to not think about something, it's louder. But you already are doing what in ACT we call cognitive diffusion, because you're realizing that that thought, that I'm not a good student thought, is really Miss Morton in my head.
Right, right.
It's not true. And could I have a really loud Miss Morton and still put myself out there in places that are, quote, not a good student places, you know, in terms of academics and interviews? So you're already doing it, but that's a great example. And namely, naming some of those narratives is a great skill to have.
You have a great story. It's really a metaphor, but it's a little story in your book about you having a neighbor with a rooster that, you know, certainly crowed at the crack of dawn, but also crowed throughout the day and sort of drove, I guess, all the neighbors crazy. And you talk about our rooster minds, and you had mentioned thoughts, that our thoughts are sort of like this rooster crowing at all these sort of odd hours that seem to have nothing to do with the rising or the setting of the sun, but just kind of, you know, reaction to what's going on. Flesh that out for us. And why are metaphors so important and even so powerful? Because I remembered that so clearly.
Well, metaphors are a way to use language to get around language. They're also very universal. And they're a way of communicating something so that you don't get all stuck in it. Actually, it's something that I train therapists in, is how to help them with creating a metaphor with their clients. Sometimes, like I did this in the last training in North Carolina, and one of the therapists came up and described sort of picking at a scab as a metaphor for something they were doing in their relationship. And once you can start talking about it as picking at a scab, then you start to, oh yeah, that's gross. Oh yeah. And you keep on wanting to go back and it doesn't let it heal and, you know, all of that. So the metaphor of the rooster was a metaphor of the mind, of how our mind tends to crow at inappropriate times. And if you are going and trying to wrangle that rooster, then you're not focusing on what you want to focus on, that back to that attentional flexibility again, right? Can you have a rooster in the back of your mind? And that rooster could be, you know, an estranged relationship that's bothering you, or a work deadline, or those 1500 emails. Can you have that in the back of your mind, but still then pay attention to what matters to you right in front of you? Because when we're caught up in our mind, sometimes I'll have clients, you know, write the thought on their hand and hold it up right in front of their face. When you're caught up in your mind, that's what you're doing. You're blocking your view. And much of psychology before, you know, these third wave approaches, these more acceptance-based approaches, what it used to do is like, can you write something different on your hand? Put a positive affirmation on there? Can you try and erase it? Or every time that pops up, you know, try and distract yourself. But that takes a lot of effort and energy. And what some of the research shows is that doing that actually makes it rebound stronger. So we're practicing noticing the rooster, but also shifting your attention to what is most important for you to focus your attention on right here and now.
Does the same apply to our emotions, to our feelings as well? I mean, that they're also have a kind of roosterish quality to them as well, in that they can seemingly pop up at times where it doesn't seem to make any sense.
Yeah, it may or may not make sense because there's classical conditioning there that is causing our emotions to pop up. But I would say both with your thoughts and with your emotions, that you are the chooser of whether or not you want to go there. And sometimes it's helpful to pay attention to some of those rooster thoughts, and it's helpful to pay attention to some of those difficult emotions. Back to somebody that may be stumbling over their words. Maybe they do need to pay attention to getting more skillful with their speaking, right? If they're socially anxious. Or somebody that's feeling anxiety, maybe that anxiety is there for a reason that needs you to make enough space for it and go to it and kind of ask, why are you here? What are you trying to tell me? Is there something important here? But that's not going to happen if you're suffocating it or trying to get rid of it or running away from it. So the flexibility part, in ACT we call it psychological flexibility, is your capacity to be with whatever is here, whatever's in the here and now inside of your body. Can you make more room for it so that you have more flexibility in your behavior with it?
I'm thinking, though, and I'm thinking of myself, but I think a lot of people that I know, is that when feelings and maybe thoughts, when they are uncomfortable, I mean, the impulse is to shoo them away, to deny them, to try to do something to make them go away. So again, it feels almost counterintuitive to embrace them, to look at them, to turn them upside down. I mean, even our body can be telling us, don't go there, you know, don't go there because it's going to be painful.
Right. We evolved to avoid painful things like a hot stove. It works really well with things outside of yourself. Don't go there if it's a hot stove. Don't put your hand on it. But what if that hot stove is your relationship with your partner, and there's something in there that needs to be worked out? But every time that person comes in the room and you feel that, you just pick out your phone and you're looking at your phone. Don't go there. Don't be present with that pain, right? Or maybe that's some kind of loss or grief. And so you shove it away for years and years and years. What the loss and grief might be showing you is that there's love, someone that you love that you never process. It's a practice. It's uncomfortable. It seems counterintuitive, but it's actually something that we can get better at. I've gotten better at it. I can be with all the feelings that are in my body and stay with them long enough to see that what hurts me the most is an arrow pointing to what I care most about. You don't hurt around things that you don't care about. You do poorly at your bowling game, you don't think about it. You lose sleep on it. But if in that bowling alley you yelled at your kids, you'll lose sleep on it. Sure. Because you care about it, right? So the shutting off of feelings, I think, is actually one of the most problematic things that we do as humans. And it's in part because what we do to shut them off adds a secondary problem. Usually it's like, you know, distraction, numbing, overworking, blocking people, but also because those feelings will tell you how you want to be what's important to you.
There's a lot of talk about our loneliness epidemic. I mean, some people feel it was exacerbated by the pandemic, and certainly the fact that so many had to either go home or we couldn't be with each other in a way that made us feel connected. As a therapist and as someone who works with these ideas that we've been talking about, how do you see the loneliness epidemic? I mean, do you see it that way, for instance?
Yeah, I think there's, I loved your interview about solitude. And so part of the loneliness epidemic is a loneliness with ourselves, inability to be with ourselves and feel already connected. You know, when I sometimes do this exercise with my kids when they can't sleep at night, and I'll say, okay, what I want you to do is I want you to imagine your neighbor down the lane and they're sleeping too, and send them a well wish to sleep. And then I want you to imagine your grandma and grandpa a mile away and imagine them in their bed sleeping too. And then I want you to imagine all the owls in the trees, you know, that are up and awake and they're watching. And all of a sudden you may be alone in your bed, but you feel connected. And that's something that I learned from, you know, we go to Plum Village Monastery, and I've been practicing Buddhism for a long time in France, which is Thich Nhat Hanh's monastery. And a couple years ago, we were there, and I was with Brother Phapu. I was actually interviewing Brother Phapu in Thich Nhat Hanh's little hut where Thich Nhat Hanh lived. And I was asking him about, you know, my son who felt alone at night. What should he do when he wakes up in the night? And it was because my son asked me to ask him this. And he said, oh, turn to your loneliness and say, hello, loneliness. I see you. I'm here for you. So sometimes, yes, we are more disconnected than ever from each other. We need to gather in person. We need to remember the groups that are important to us. Our weak ties are very important. And we also need to practice being with ourselves and recognizing our interconnection, that we are never alone. Every single breath you take, you are taking because some tree or algae or living being has created something for you to breathe. Therefore, you are never alone.
We've been focusing largely on the self, but you also write about, you know, our relationship with other people, and you describe there are relationship supporters and then there are relationship depleters. And I do want to talk about that, but I'm also wondering whether in our relationship with ourselves, the way we've been talking, whether we also have that relationship supporter in ourselves and that depleter also in ourselves.
How do you feel about me turning the table on you, Martin?
Sure, go for it.
Do you have a relationship supporter and a relationship depleter?
In myself or in the world? In myself.
In yourself.
In myself. Yeah. Yes. Yeah. Yes. I mean, I think like you, I'm an empath. So I feel like that is, in a sense, my superpower. It's a thing that seems to come naturally and it helps me navigate the world. So that feels like this support. And I guess Miss Morton would be the depleter that I carry. Right?
Miss Morton's a depleter and the empath is a supporter.
Yeah.
And does that empath support you? Do you find that feeds you energy, that part of you?
Mostly, but sometimes it instead of focusing on myself, I'm so focused on people outside myself that I will sometimes forget about me.
Yeah, exactly. Sometimes it's the genius that we have in the outside world that we don't turn towards ourselves, right? And then Miss Morton, who had that very strong statement about you not being a student, did she ever have anything that was helpful about her?
No.
Or was she, no, completely helpful.
Yeah.
So she's like completely unhelpful over there, nagging away at you. And why do you think she's still around?
Yeah, well, I only have a minute left here. That's a whole hour of discussion. But yeah, part of me believes her. So what can I say?
That's what I would suggest, is that there's a part of you that thinks that she is helping you achieve what you're achieving. And I would encourage your empath self to question that. Is that true?
Yeah.
Is it kind? Is it helpful? Is it timely? Those are some of the aspects of wise speech that we can use towards ourselves.
Well, we're almost out of time here, but we're also up on Thanksgiving. Any advice for getting through Thanksgiving In 30 seconds or less?
Oh, gosh. Well, there's a big question. I would ask yourself, what would be my nightmare review of Thanksgiving dinner? And that will tell you a lot about what you care about and how you don't want to be and what is unwise effort. And then ask yourself, not your nightmare review of what everyone else would be doing, but what you would be doing, how you would be acting. And then ask yourself, what would be my genius review of Thanksgiving dinner? If I showed up, how I want to show up with the wisest form of effort, what would that look like? Write down a few words, put them on a sticky note, put them in your phone, and those can be your guiding principles of how you step into it, independent of how anyone else shows up. You can engage in wise effort.
Well, we have to leave it there. Thank you so much, Diane Hill, for joining us today on The Connection.
Thank you.
You're welcome. And again, the book is called Wise Effort, How to Focus Your Genius Energy on What Matters Most. And thank you for joining us today on The Connection. You can download a podcast of the show wherever you get your podcasts. And you can listen on the WHYY app. You can check us out on Instagram and find us on Facebook. Al Banks, the engineer for today's edition of the show. Debbie Builder produces The Connection. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Thank you for joining us.